This is the second day of this July 2010 7-day session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of Foyan, who is also, his other name is Wumen or Mumon, the compiler of the Mumon Kan. He lived in the 12th century, China, and we're reading from a text called Instant Zen. Here we're hearing him speak in the first person. When I first called on a certain teacher, he taught me to work on the saying, "What is the great meaning of Buddhism? Next to the city of the king of Chu, the river flows eastward." That's the exchange that is kind of, he was told to work on as kind of a koan. He also taught me to contemplate the saying, "It's not the movement of the wind, nor the movement of the flag, but the movement of your mind." This comes from a very famous exchange that took place between the Wei Nung, the sixth patriarch, and another group of monks who were arguing about a flag flapping in the wind, and one was taking the position of subjectivity and the other of objectivity. It's the wind, the other said it's the flag, and then the sixth patriarch settled the matter by saying it's the movement of your mind. Then when I left and went to call on teachers all over the land, I asked them questions. The ancients were wholly true to reality, and the old teachers explained in countless ways, but I simply could not understand. Finally, I left to travel to eastern China, but halfway there, I turned around and came back. Now I was told to contemplate the story. There's another koan for him. If you kill your parents, you repent before Buddha. If you kill Buddha, where do you repent? And then the second part of that, of this koan, is the response by Yunmen or Ummon. He said, "Exposed." And then Wumen continues, "This case study is like a hot iron ball in the mind, and I suffered all kinds of trouble for 7 years. Those of you who have practiced Zen for a long time will know what I mean." So just to recap here, he was given this first exchange to ponder. What is the great meaning of Buddhism? Next to the city, the river flows eastward. And he's given the other one. It's not the movement of it's not the wind, it's not the flag, it's your mind that moves. And then he's given this last one that he worked on for 7 years. If you kill your parents, you repent before Buddha. If you kill Buddha, where do you repent? Exposed. And then he goes on, "Let me tell you another story. When Huai Tang started to study Zen, he first saw so-and-so. For 3 years, he could not understand what so-and-so was talking about. He also trained with Zen Master Nan, and after 2 years, still did not understand. Then he went to spend a summer retreat in a cloister in Transmission of the Lamp, a very famous text about the stories of the awakening experiences of the whole ancestral line. He read the story where someone asked Duo Fu, 'What is the bamboo grove of Duo Fu?' He replied, 'One cane, two canes slanted.'" Sounds like our dividers. At this, Huai Tang finally opened up and awakened. Now, in another selection in this collection of teachings by Wu Men, he says, if you have just now understood, where is that which you couldn't understand before? If you can't understand now, when will you understand? That's a provocative question. If you can't understand now, when will you understand? Just examine over and over in this way, and you should come to understand. It is said, when light comes, darkness vanishes. When knowledge comes into play, confusion is forgotten. And then he says, but can it actually be so? How can it be so? That would mean there is darkness to be destroyed and there is confusion to be removed. Have you not read the ancient saying, don't change the former person, just change the former behavior? So he's provoking these questions to invite us not to just automatically accept what knowledge we've picked up, especially if it is in the form of just ordinary sayings or cliches. So he presents this one, when light comes, darkness vanishes. When knowledge comes into play, confusion is forgotten. And he says, how can that be? That would mean there is darkness to be destroyed and there is confusion to be removed. Awakening reveals that there is only this enlightened nature. It sounds impossible. And to our logical mind, it is. But there it is. There is only this enlightened nature. So you say, what about all of the greed, anger, and delusion, and so forth? That's not apart from this enlightened nature. Nothing is apart from our Buddha nature. Nothing can be. He's warning us not to fall into these dichotomies, such as lightness and darkness. Lao Tzu says the same thing. In other words, he says, behind the divisible, there is always something indivisible. And Sun Tzu, the third or fourth ancestor, in Affirming Faith in Mind, urges us to keep in mind not to. This not to is good advice, even while we're sitting. If we're caught in this or that. And this happens. I hear it in Doksan. I certainly went through it myself, where you're confronted with what seems to be a dichotomy. Should I be doing this or should I be doing that? Is it this way or is it that way? Anytime we notice two-ness in the mind, we're snagged. We're snagged by this discriminating mind. And our job is to see what is beyond all such discriminations. Whether it's light and dark, before and after, right and wrong, superior and inferior. It's a key part of maturing practice to notice when we're trafficking in dualities. That's the hard part, just noticing it. Because once we notice it, then we can drop it. We can just obliterate that two-ness in the breath or the koan. And then he quotes an ancient saying, don't change the former person, just change the former behavior. This points to the truth that there is no person as such. There's no fixed entity. We talk about the self or maybe the person, but this is where language can deceive us, because there is no static selfhood anywhere in any of us. Through long habit, this is the way we think. Our we default to the I and the me. But ultimately, there is no such one. So if there is no ego, no self, unchanging self, then the very idea of changing that one is absurd. The saying, don't change the former person, just change the former behavior, places things where they ought to be, which is in process. Each one of us is not a noun, we're a verb. And I'm told that in the Hopi language, almost everything is verbs. So they wouldn't say table. The literal translation would be tabling. Or instead of fan, it's fanning. Instead of Larry, it's larrying. And the beauty of this is it reveals the dynamic nature of this so-called self. It's a continuing process of change. Our thinking is so bound to language. This is where you see the self congealing so clearly when as a child we start using language. And so this is the wonderful down-to-earth, practical quality of Zen practice is we're not asked to somehow alter a person. We just have to learn to examine and work with our thinking, our attention, how we use our attention, as well as our behavior, our conduct. And then he takes to task what must be lots of monks of his day who just latch on to some phony way of presenting their understanding. He said, "You Zen followers say, what is the difficulty? Misunderstanding is just this person, and understanding is just this person. There can be no other." This is something we read from yesterday. It's the same crew he's taking to task yesterday. From birth to death, it's just this person. And he says, people today simply say, this is this person. Who else is there? There couldn't be any other. And now he picks up that attack again. He says, but then when asked what this person is, you are helpless, or else you talk at random. This is because of not having attained truly accurate realization. This is a disease that has entered your bones and marrow. I've often felt how fortunate we are in this era of Zen in the West, that we don't have people, these phonies, who go around making these pronouncements and feigning understanding. But there's still time yet. People in error attach recognition to a lifetime of cessation. Well, that'll be clarified as we go on. Indeed, they stop, that's in quotation marks, they stop not only for one lifetime, but for 1,000 lifetimes. As for the spiritually sharp, they should know how to experientially investigate who this person is, directly seeking an insight. Well, he seems to be, when he says people in error attach recognition to a lifetime of cessation, it seems to be a very ponderous way of saying that people become attached to they're getting stuck in certain notions of stillness. He goes on, "Who? Buddhism today is lackluster. Even in large groups, it's hard to find suitable people. As long as you people are here practicing this path, you should not waste the 24 hours of the day. Focus on attaining insight." Then he says, "You people are still not far off. Have you not read how Master Lin Chi said, 'There is a true person of no rank in the red mass of flesh, always going out and coming in the doors of your senses. Those who haven't witnessed it, look.' That's a very famous teaching by Linji or Rinzai. And then Wu Men continues, at that time a student came forward and asked, what is the true person of no rank? Linji got out of his chair, grabbed the student, and said, speak, speak. The student hesitated, trying to think of something. Linji pushed him away. Of course, the question is, who is this true self? And Linji added this very visceral, concrete element to it by saying there's this person of no rank. No rank, you got to understand, in a Confucian society, no rank would be inconceivable. How can you not have rank? Everything is ordered hierarchically in a Confucian society. We heard from in our in the annual meeting of the American Zen Teachers Association that we hosted here last week. We had a guest speaker who had spent a lot of time training in Japan, and he explained to us that when you enter a traditional monastery in Japan, there aren't many left actually, but of these. Training sodos are called S-O-D-O. It means like a training monastery. They're very small. When you enter, you're given a number based on that date, and then you take your place. So he said when he entered Daitokuji Monastery, he was number 20, and then in his 11 or 12 years there, he worked up to number 10 in the order. And it's very important to them it's based on seniority. And everyone above you, let's say when he got to number 10, then the nine people above him all had authority over him. And then he had authority over the 10 people below him. So here, Linji presents this idea, the true person of no rank in the naked mass of flesh, always going out and coming in the doors of your senses. Of course, he's talking about mind, awareness. Buddha. That's one way to understand the word Buddha, as awareness with a capital A, enlightened awareness. This one who sees, hears, smells, tastes, feels, thinks. Who is that one who right now hears my voice? What is mu? He goes on, here I only require you to practice. your first priority, 24 hours a day, should be to get rid of unenlightened egotism toward others. Why? Egotism toward others is the business of mediocrities. That's quite a statement. It really places egotism, self-centeredness, right where it belongs, in the world of the mediocre. The cause of our sorrow is ego delusion, we recite in the Hakuin chant. The cause of others' sorrow is ego delusion, our ego delusion, as well as others. If we bring forth this fundamental awareness of our Buddha nature, if we bring it forth, we become acutely aware of our tendencies toward self-centeredness. Right here in Sesshin, we don't have a lot of wiggle room in Sesshin, the schedule being what it is, and are having to follow the daily schedule and comply with the guidelines. But even in Sesshin, that is so structured, that is structured in a way that we don't have as many opportunities to exercise our self-centeredness, even here, there are ways that we can do this if we're not careful. At meals, every once in a while, I hear about someone or other who is taking way more than their share of a certain kind of food at the served. They might like. I remember this from many years ago when we served sprouts. Someone might decide that sprouts are really good for them, so when the basket of salad is passed around, they would plunder the sprouts and leaving almost nothing for anyone else. And they might justify this by saying, well, I'm not eating the casserole or the other vegetables. I'm not eating much of that. I'm just going to major in sprouts. This is a little form of self-centeredness. I don't really see this much. It's not unknown, but luckily it's I don't really see it much, where you might stand and watch others struggling with the dividers, just sort of maybe because your mind is just wandering, you're in daydreaming, and you're just leaving it to others to put things back. Or being noisy or careless in your bedroom, not being sensitive to the effects of the way you're moving on your roommate. Every once in a while I become aware that someone is hoarding cushions, storing cushions under their tan that they almost never use. Just so they have all their options to choose from. During the work period, sometimes work may run a little bit late, and people will, rather than just pitching in to help others you're working with, you just bail out because you want to get to your room to nap or get to the zendo. Even that's another form of egotism. Oh, I want to get to the zendo so I can dissolve my ego in zazen, and leaving others to clean up after you or to do the work, the extra work that is involved. moment after moment, we have choices. Do you want to go with the well-traveled route, which is self-centeredness, looking out for number one? Or do we want to cut a new path, which is helping others, extending ourselves, giving up our preferences? So much of it comes down to preferences, doesn't it? It's right there in Affirming Faith and Mind. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. When preferences are cast aside, we so stubbornly cling to our preferences. And not knowing that our very clinging to our preferences is what impedes our progress. It binds us to this illusory self. He goes on, people now want to understand theoretically at once, as soon as anything is said. How can you learn the way in this fashion? Sometimes I see beginners come to Doksan helpless to do anything about the fact that they have already seen through them. They are like villagers armed with carrying poles trying to do battle with a general. Here I am fully equipped. In my hand is the 100-pound sword of a legendary warrior, while they have nothing but a carrying pole. They strike a blow, and seeing the man not move, they strike several more times and leave. It's not that I fear them, it's because they are no match for me. Ha ha. This may sound too at first blush as though he's just boasting about his spiritual powers, but that can't be. Not someone like this. The way we can understand this is that it's his sword of no sword, his non-abiding mind, his non-clinging mind is the ultimate strength, holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in Prajna wisdom. This is the 100-pound sword. It's not having anything. Zen practice doesn't give us anything. We can't get anything from Zen practice. We just lose what binds us. We lose our fetters. Our thoughts, the thoughts we cling to. This is what restores to us our intrinsic strength. At another time, Wu Men, Foyan, Mumon, said, as soon as you accept and approve anything, recognizing it as your own, you are immediately bound hand and foot and cannot move. So even if there are 1,000 possibilities, nothing is right once you have recognized, accepted, and approved it as your own. Now, what's this all about? I have to say that this translator and his brothers, the Cleary boys, another Zen teacher put it this way, their translations are quick and dirty. And I do find that it's easy to be left, when you read a paragraph like this, left wondering what the hell is he talking about. But this is what I think it is. He's really talking about our tendency to identify with something or someone. And in that way, by identifying with it, we are bound. We lose our freedom. So by identification, I mean getting caught in the my. So my religion. To some degree, probably all of us, at least slightly, are identified with Zen or with Buddhism. It's part of our identity. I'm a Zen practitioner. I do Buddhism. So there's an identification. Gender. I'm a man. I'm a woman. This can be very subtle. But we narrow ourselves down. That's where he says, even if there are 1,000 possibilities, nothing is right once you have, well, identified with it. We shrink as soon as we are attached to. Okay, yes, we practice Zen. You could say, yeah, if you had to fill out an application form under religion, all right, you can put Zen or Buddhist. But it's so, we so easily have these identifications woven into our tissues. Certainly our opinions. I'm a environmentalist. I'm a Republican. That's one of the worst, is the partisan politics. We identify with one group, and then we have to defend that. This is what follows identification. We identify with a gender, we have to defend the gender. Identify with a religion, we have to defend it. We identify with a political party, we have to defend it. We identify with an opinion of any kind, global warming or non-global warming. Then this is what engenders conflict. There is a difference between believing something and being attached to the belief. That's where we get in trouble. It's the same with preferences. Of course, we have preferences just based on our many things about our personality and character. We like some colors more than others, maybe, or some kinds of foods more than other kinds. Some brands of food more than other kinds. But it's when we get attached to these preferences, it's when we get attached to what we identify with, that we set ourselves up for discontent, if not conflict. And when we bring this light of awareness of our self-nature, when we bring that to bear on the mind, when we really see, when we really look and see the mind as it works, in Sesshin or out of Sesshin, when we really see, we come to recognize how subtle and deeply ingrained these habits of identification are. All we have to do is notice what the body tells us in reacting to people when we hear something that is contrary to our opinions or our identification. The body never lies. It's part of practice, is noticing the reactions in the body. The reactions that normally we don't notice because they're so faint. I'm talking about anger. What provokes anger in us? That's right there. That's our attachment. wonderful biofeedback system, this practice in the largest sense, not just sitting, but practice. Practice means awareness. When do we flinch mentally, if not physically? When do we tighten up a little bit, just a little tighten up to what someone says or does? That's where we're attached. And then he goes on, gives us an analogy of this, how this identifying, getting attached to the I, the me, and the my, how this hamstrings us. He says, it is like making a boat and outfitting it for a long journey to a land of treasures. Then as soon as you are about to get started, you drive a stake in the ground and tie the boat down, then row with all your might. You may row till the end of time, but you will still be at the shore. You see the boat moving from side to side and think you are on the move, but actually you haven't gotten anywhere. Practice means relinquishing our attachments. People new to practice, they hear the word attachment, they think it means smoking or sweets or whatever. They think just the obvious physical attachments we may have. But those are nothing compared to our mental attachments, our clinging to notions of, clinging to our opinions, and our other notions. Well, we came to the end of a chapter here, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.